This is episode number 50. So cheers. Thank you for joining me on the journey. Okay, so number 15, can Bitcoin be hacked? This is, again, an unbelievably good question. So I think it's fair to say that in life, nothing's impossible, right? So absolutely, it could be. Has anyone managed to do it in a meaningful way? No. Will they manage to do it in a meaningful way? I don't believe so. Why do I think those things? Well, mainly just years of study. Like, the whole point of starting a Bitcoin podcast in many ways is, someone somewhere, please tell me why I'm wrong. Like, please come with a reasoned argument and a bunch of reasons that say you're all mental and this thing's going to, you know, fade away and die, and, you know, allocating to Bitcoin is completely, you know, it's a waste of time. And so far, I haven't found that. And neither have all the other people that, you know, constantly Bitcoin podcast as well. So it's not just to, like, have many hundreds of hours I've been asking people questions as podcasts, but also the hundreds of hours that other people have been asking questions as podcasts, and still no one has come to the conclusion that, like, yeah, this is why it's going to break. Yeah, if you can find someone that can hack Bitcoin, please, you know, let me know. Again, this is beginner content, so I'll try and talk through, like, the actual fundamental reasons why. Well, basically, this is where the blockchain itself is useful. So, as we've said, you have a network of hardware devices called ASICs that are constantly hashing the SHA-256 algorithm, and they're trying to guess. It's a guessing game, essentially. And the more guesses you can make, the higher the chances you'll get the guess right. And sometimes the chance of getting the guess right changes based on the difficulty adjustment, and they make it more difficult or less difficult depending on the block times, depending on the network activity, depending on how much, you know, hash rate's actually plugged in. Now, for someone to go and change the blockchain, they have to get the entire network to trick the whole network. And what's so clever about Bitcoin is that is exceedingly expensive. Like, extraordinarily expensive. And so you could spend a huge amount of real world energy trying to trick the network into spending coins twice, for example. Like, that would be the obvious thing. And the reason that that's so difficult is because, and then that's the double spend problem, right? If you pass someone a $10 note, you can't spend that $10 again. But a digital dollar that can be literally just, like, printed on a keyboard, well, you can spend as many of them as you want, right? That's essentially what central banks are doing all the time. They're double spending constantly by inflating their balance sheets. And you really, really want to avoid that with your base layer digital money, which is what Bitcoin is. In short, there's a whole load of... another way of thinking of this, sorry, I'll flip it the other way, is Bitcoin, the more you study it, is this, like, vortex of positive incentives where all these different things combine together to create the perfect money. And I've heard it described as, like, the Immaculate Conception. It's just this extraordinary moment in time where all of these different areas of computer science came together using technology that in a lot of cases didn't exist before and created Bitcoin. The problem that had previously not been solved in computer science was to do with decentralized consensus. And it's called the Byzantine Generals problem. And so, to give a physical example, you've got a city. And that city is surrounded by 8 armies. And the most efficient way of attacking that city is for all 8 armies to go at the same time. And that will guarantee victory. But if one army was to go first, they would sack the city and get everything. And so how do you avoid independent actors from sabotaging the benefits of the group? And how do you ensure that the group wins? And no one had been able to solve this problem from a computer science perspective until Bitcoin. And it's the blend of cryptography and the proof of work hashing algorithm and a number of other different parts of the design that combined together to mean that that was the case. That's how Bitcoin stops double spending. And that's how Bitcoin is the discovery of digital scarcity. And basically, this vortex of positive incentive makes hacking Bitcoin insanely hard. And I know people have tried, and I know people will try in the future, but it's not been possible, basically. if anyone can, please let me know, because it would be, well, that's the whole point of this research, right? Let's keep asking questions. Why are we wrong? Why are we wrong? Why are we wrong? So number 16, what can I buy with Bitcoin? Great question. Anything you want. Literally anything you want. What can you buy with money? Is essentially what that question is. You want to buy someone's time as a consultant? Go for it. You want to buy a house? Go for it. You want to buy a coffee? Go for it. Every single day, people are using Bitcoin. And you think back to that three feature set that I discussed, which was the medium of exchange, unit of account, and store of value. People are using Bitcoin for those three things every single day. And Bitcoin, there's no such thing as a bank holiday, right? It's Sunday night, Bitcoin's moving. Saturday morning, Bitcoin's moving. Monday night, Bitcoin's moving, whatever the case is. So you can buy anything with Bitcoin at any time of day, anywhere in the world, at any time, should you be working with a counterparty that accepts Bitcoin. I guess that's probably the key, right? You might have to sell your Bitcoin for the local currency and then pay for something, but you could still do that. I do that all the time. Or you're able to directly transfer someone Bitcoin. But absolutely, you can buy whatever you want. It's like, the question is stupid. It's like, what can I buy with money? Well, you buy everything with money. So this beer, for example, how did I buy this beer? Well, I bought it with money. Money is 50% of every single transaction that happens. And so this question is like, what can I buy with money, i.e. 50% of every transaction? Or every trade. It's a kind of stupid question, but basically anything. 17, why does Bitcoin's price fluctuate so much? Great question. In some ways, Bitcoin is a true reflection of reality, in my opinion. And what I mean by that is life is crazy, right? One minute you're happy, the next minute you're sad. One minute you're angry, the next minute you're Zen meditating. That's life. And it's unsurprising to me that the price of money tracks volatility like that. Now, what's a lot less natural is a completely stable price. Like, humans aren't stable. And this is one of the interesting parts of this that just shines a light on the stupidity of central banking in some ways and their supposed high-level goal of, like, we're going to create maximum employment and we're going to give you stable prices. It's like, okay, but like we discussed before, value is subjective. The Bitcoin price, which is the most liquid international product for money, or the most saleable good, right, as discussed before, it's volatile because different people in different time zones speaking different languages with different problems are using it all the time. And so what to someone is a great buy price, to someone else is a great sell price. Yes, there are other reasons for its volatility, but I think that's the main one, right? It's actually the first time that we've got a measuring stick on human activity. And to dig into that a bit further, like, well, what is a price? Price is in some ways a reflection of the inputs of a good or a service. And what a price tells us is a huge amount of information. But what it really is we're talking about the language of value. And value, in many ways, is subjective, but prices are used to measure it. Now, another really cool part of learning about Bitcoin is, like, if you think about a 30-centimeter ruler, that doesn't change in length, right? It's a distance. It doesn't change. We use rulers for measuring distance. What about the temperature? Well, you might have a temperature gauge somewhere, and it says it's, you know, 15 degrees or 20 degrees Celsius. It doesn't change, right? You see the measuring stick or the measuring tool used doesn't fluctuate. Now, when it comes to money, at least the commonly used money, how many pounds are in existence? How many euros are in existence? How many US dollars are in existence? Ultimately, we actually don't even know. Like, the Bank of England stopped producing reports over a decade ago as to how many pounds it's printing. I try to find this information out. You literally can't. So they talk about M2 money supply and global liquidity. And in many ways, Bitcoin tracks the total money supply. That's very helpful metric in some ways. It's like, from a macro perspective, what the hell's going on here? Well, basically all these central banks are printing money at a certain pace. Some are inflating at 2% a year. Some are inflating at 20% a year. Some are inflating at 200% a year. But they all combine together to create global liquidity. And that is, generally speaking, what is driving asset prices. So there's this fascinating thing where you can start looking at, we'll say, the FTSE 100, you know, the top 100 companies in the UK. You track the FTSE 100's growth against gold, not really going anywhere. You track the FTSE 100's growth against the M2 money supply, not really going anywhere. It's absolutely crazy. And so when you start studying the history of money and how it affects people and what's happened before, like, another great book to reference is When Money Dies. And this is a period of time after World War One, and the Germans, they had, at the time, it's called the Weimar Republic. And basically they hyperinflated. And everyone thought they were getting rich because the stock market was going up, the house prices are going up. But really what was happening is the denominator that they were measuring value in was disintegrating in value. And that's what's happening today. There's a really core point, and we spoke about this earlier, purchasing power. Purchasing power is the question or the frame or the lens that you have to look at everything with. And so when you get someone who's a wealth advisor and they come to say, oh, we made you 4% this year. Okay, what was your fee? 1%. Okay. And what was your funds fee? They go, oh, that was another 1% or whatever. Okay, what was the CPI? Oh, that was 3%. All right, well, what was real inflation? Oh, well, no one knows what that is. Okay, well, how did house prices go up in central London? 12%. Okay, what did the oil price do? 10%. What did the gold price do? 18%. Okay, so suddenly you're looking at these other metrics that, measured in pounds or measured in euros or measured in US dollars, whatever it is, the denominator is disintegrating. There's no place that shows this better than real estate. And you can ask a real estate broker that sold the same house 4 times in the last 10 years, why has that price gone up? And they'll give you the same bullshit. Immigration's changed, interest rates changed. Oh, we've had a lot of new people move to the area for some reason, or that school was built or whatever. Now, there's no doubt that there are physical limits to population growth and to areas and geographic zones that mean that house prices fluctuate. But are you telling me that they move as much as they've moved because of just that? No. And so you track real estate prices to the liquidity levels in the local currency, and you'll find it's basically flat. So there's basically one big lie going on. Why does Bitcoin's price fluctuate so much? It's essentially a map of reality in my mind. And what is not reality, or what is unnatural, is the idea of a stable price. And what's also going on is all the money printing. And so when you look at a price, well, hang on, this can of beer, okay, 1 year this is going to cost you $10, and the year before it cost you $8, and then next year it's going to cost you $12. Well, how many dollars were in the system when those prices were made? Honestly, it's very, very hard to find that information out. Now, how many Bitcoins are there? 21 million. How many have been issued? I think it's like 19 or something. And so you start to see this picture where, yes, Bitcoin is extremely volatile in the short term, but it's for a reason, which is that humans are completely crazy. And also, it's the first time that we're using a measuring stick that's not changing. And so the idea that, like, 6 blokes can get together every quarter and be like, okay, I think the price of money should be 4%. You know, and that's what an interest rate is on base money from a central bank. Whereas Bitcoin is the price of money in real time, traded 365, 24/7. It's absolutely wild what's going on. So welcome to the language of value, and welcome to another way of looking at the world completely. Okay, we're through to question number 18. It's now 9 o'clock at night, my Saturday night. This has gone a little longer than I expected, but beer number 2, and hopefully this will be also episode 50. So awesome. Thank you so much for your time, and great to be here. Is Bitcoin a good investment? You got to decide. No one else will ever, ever, ever answer that question for you except for yourself. Can I help you decide? Yes. Emphatically, yes. Bitcoin is an excellent investment. But be careful, because you have to frame it in the right sense. So for people that invest, what are you looking for? you're looking for capital protection, perhaps, or capital growth. And you have a number of different asset classes that you can deploy capital into, whether that be equities, whether that be debt, whether that be classic cars, whether that be art, whether that be real estate. And in some ways, Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency is just another bucket of asset class that you can look to for an investment. And then you want to be thinking about things like risk, things like liquidity, things like volatility. It depends what you're looking for, right? If you're 65 and you're basically retiring, you probably want something a bit more relaxed that is definitely going to be around and you don't want to take too much risk. If you're 25 years old, you just made your first bonus and you want to take a bit of risk and grow your wealth, these are very, very different stages in life. So what kind of investment are you making? What are you looking for? And really think long and hard about that. Again, because beginner content, what I would urge us to think through, though, is Bitcoin even an investment itself? And this, for me, was a massive, massive understanding shift, which is there's a difference between saving and investing. It's like, Jake, what are you talking about? Well, I spoke already about this brilliant question, like, what is money? Okay. Now, we thought, we go, what is money? And then we talk through the history of money, the characteristics of a good money, and the feature set of money. And so money, in a sound money sense, in an Austrian school sense, has three abilities: medium of exchange, unit of account, and store of value. Now, I touched on this earlier. When I received my inheritance in my 20s, I knew that if I left that inheritance in a bank in pounds, inflation would just eat it, right? Even if, like, on a 10-year time horizon, you're going to be able to buy less stuff. This is where the word purchasing power is so important. So I received my inheritance. If I just left it in the bank, I knew for sure that I could buy less stuff in the future. That is not a smart or useful, like, wealth generation tool for future generations. Like, you're guaranteed to go backwards, essentially. Okay, well, that means that basically pounds do not have the feature of store of value. Now, pounds might be used as a unit of account. Pounds might be used as a medium of exchange, but they do not do store of value. Now, I could have just bought gold, but I wasn't sophisticated enough at the time to understand this, what I'm chatting through now. So the next point being, it's like, okay, well, hang on. So if Bitcoin is just money, and money performs these three things, if you just own Bitcoin and use it for its store of value purpose, you're actually just saving, right? And Bitcoin as money is the most saleable good. So when you go to the marketplace with the most saleable good, you can buy anything you want. But also, people want to buy it from you for the things that they have. And so by definition, Bitcoin is a savings technology. It's just money. And so when I get asked the question, is Bitcoin a good investment? It's like, okay, well, yes, with the traditional investment lens on, there's a whole number of reasons why you could be super bullish about owning Bitcoin, whether that be S-curve technology adoption thesis, whether that be simply, like, you know, connecting the concept of digital scarcity and digital gold, or just the fact that, you know, historical gains have been very good. It's likely to carry on. But is it really an investment? It's like, well, actually, no. I feel like when I own Bitcoin, you'll see this phrase in the investment space about risk on assets and risk off assets. And most people would look at Bitcoin as something risky, right? It's like, oh, yeah, you're taking a gamble with Bitcoin. Like, don't put too much in. But actually, what if it's not? What if Bitcoin is the least risky option out there today with the best risk reward upside? And that's where this counterparty thing comes in that I spoke about before, where if you store your Bitcoin correctly, you get extraordinary potential capital gains returns with really low risk. You've got the largest computer network ever invented by mankind as your security guard for your investment that no one can take from you with the best upside ever seen. I mean, this thing is insane. So yes, Bitcoin is a great investment, and I think of myself as an investor, and I allocate capital, and Bitcoin for me is the best place to allocate capital. The second best for me would be a family home, which I'm working on as hard as I can, but it hasn't yet fallen into place for me, so that will come. But a house is an investment, and if anything, it's only mapping the speed at which they print the local currency, and it costs money. So I'd think of a house almost as a liability in a way, and is only worth owning if you can get in with leverage. So you're borrowing local currency and keeping as much Bitcoin as you can. That's a whole nother story. Understand that saving and investing are not the same thing. Bitcoin is making money great again and gives you the ability to save. Question 19, what is a Bitcoin halving? Great question. So a technical part of how Bitcoin actually functions, and it's basically the process by which the Bitcoin network issues Bitcoin. So when Bitcoin first started back in 2009, it said in its code that there will be 21 million Bitcoins. And it started issuing Bitcoins to Bitcoin miners that were helping to facilitate transactions that were happening on the network. And what was happening at the time was a certain amount of Bitcoin was given out as a reward for each block, and they're called block rewards. And what happens is after a specific period of time, which is roughly every 4 years, the block reward is split in half. It essentially went 50 to 25 to 12 and a half to 6 to 3. And it will keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So every 4 years, the amount of new Bitcoin entering the market gets smaller, which is really interesting when it comes to the supply and demand mechanics of Bitcoin itself. So thinking back to, for example, gold mining and the ability for the supply of gold to increase. So if the gold price, which at the moment is happening, right, we're running well into the $3,000 an ounce. Gold's the most expensive it's ever been in fiat currency terms. And one of the reasons I think for that is people are running to gold as a store of value over government bonds, which they see as not just capital risk, but also counterparty risk now, which is very interesting. But the process here is, like, if the gold price shoots to $4,000 an ounce, there are people out there that are specialists in sourcing, producing, and selling gold. And they'll go, oh, that project that we looked at that one time, that we know there's gold there, but actually it was too expensive to get to market and the market price was only 1,000 or 1,500 bucks an ounce. They didn't go and get that gold. But the moment the price runs to 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, it makes all of these other projects that were harder to get to market feasible. And that, like any supply and demand mechanics, as the price goes up, then additional supply can be added to the market. And with the additional supply, that puts pressure on the price. So with Bitcoin, it doesn't work like that. And this is the crazy thing about it. If the Bitcoin price goes up, you can't just start creating more Bitcoin like you can with gold. And that's what's wild. That's what I think will break the diminishing returns model, frankly. Maybe I'm not enough of an expert to comment on diminishing returns, but I just think there will come a point where it's like there's no more Bitcoin. Everyone's just holding on to it, and the price will just start. It will start absolutely running in ways that we can't imagine. There's another good way of looking at it as well, which is the idea of a Veblen good. So there are people out there that are super rich, and they go into a, you know, Gucci store, and they're like, "What's the most expensive thing you sell?" And they'll be like, "This thing over here." And they're like, "Cool, I'll take it." And if two people walked into that store at the same time with that same mentality, they both want the same thing, then the other one will just pay more for it. So there are examples out there of goods that become in higher demand the more expensive they get. And it's called a Veblen good. So I think Bitcoin will perform like that, in that the more expensive Bitcoin gets, the more the demand will come. How is Bitcoin different from traditional money? I'm going to throw this back at you and be like, if you haven't understood how Bitcoin is different from other forms of money by now, then you probably shouldn't be listening. Like, come on, I've been going 2 hours here. It's okay, fair enough though. Beginner content. Beginners compare Bitcoin to fiat currencies like the dollar or the euro. Okay, so why is Bitcoin different to the euro? Bitcoin is a decentralized network that is backed by real world energy through Bitcoin mining and is policed by Bitcoin nodes. And it is not changed since it was created. It is a system of rules, not rulers. And it is a meritocracy as a result. So it's basically very beneficial for if you're productive, you get paid. If you're not, then you won't. And I think that's a great thing. The idea that it cannot be censored, it can't be changed, very, very, very important. And I think probably the main difference is what we've touched on already, which is the supply. So there's 21 million Bitcoins that will ever exist. I don't know how many euros exist today. I have no idea how many will exist in 6 months or in 6 years. And no one knows. Even the central bankers that are in control of the euro's monetary supply, they don't know either. And that's why that 21 million is so important, because we know the monetary policy of Bitcoin. We have no idea what the euro supply is going to do in 6 months from now. Another really important point to make actually is that, like, a fiat currency, why is it that? Well, it's a currency that's pushed on the people by decree. So in an environment in which a government didn't have this monopoly on money, would someone use the euro? Would someone use the US dollar? And I think it's pretty clear to me that they wouldn't, right? It's only because these governments have militaries behind them that people even begin to use them. There are some benefits, obviously, like the US dollar in particular has become, in a sense, the fiat currency of choice globally. And I think that the acceptability of US dollars anywhere in the world at any time is probably now a self-reinforcing fact as to why someone might use it. But when a central bank issues debt, they are creating an input on their centralized bookkeeping system or ledger for double entry bookkeeping, like I touched on before. And it's not backed by anything, right? It's not redeemable for gold. It's literally just a line in a piece of paper saying the government has just, you know, paid us for this 10-year bond that sold in the open market for XYZ. And now either the central bank owns the bond or large commercial banks own those bonds. And so the whole fiat system is built on debt, and debt is essentially an IOU, and it's built on there's a huge amount of trust involved in the way that the system is managed. And if one person isn't propping the system up as effectively as they could be, then the whole thing falls to pieces like a house of cards. And that's why you see bank runs, and you've got the process of fractional reserve banking. Coin is a totally independent free market innovation that governments can't control and won't control, and is largely used, in my opinion, by individuals, like private individuals in different parts of the world, sending, receiving, and storing value. All right, we made it. Question number 21. What are the risks of using Bitcoin? Like I touched on, I spend a huge amount of time asking, where am I wrong? What have I not seen that is going to completely screw this up? And that's essentially a question of risk. So there's different ways of managing risk, right? One, don't buy more than you can afford to lose. That's probably the most simple entry-level approach. Okay, calculate your net worth. What's everything I own today? What do I think I could sell it for? What's all the debt that I've got? Okay, assets minus liabilities. Cool. This is my net wealth. What's 1% of that? Okay, buy Bitcoin with 1%. If it disappeared, you'll survive, right? There's almost like a portfolio allocation to it. And it says, what are the risks of using Bitcoin? I guess that's a risk of Bitcoin itself. I guess let me approach that first. Yeah, so first of all, it's like if you don't put too much in, then if it goes to zero, then it doesn't matter that much. Risks to Bitcoin, there's tons that get rolled out, but we covered most of them. I don't believe there's a regulatory risk to Bitcoin at all. Yes, some jurisdictions will ride it harder than others, and you will always have the ability to move. This is the beauty of digital wealth. So if what's going on here in Australia right now is fascinating. The government is proposing a unrealized capital gain on all of the super funds that exist, which is basically the pension pots of Australians. So you've got people that, you know, spent 30, 40 years working, and they've got an asset base in their super fund that they own. It's in their name that the government forced their employers to pay them. And now the government's going to come along and say, you haven't even sold these assets, but we're going to take a percentage of the increase since you purchased them. Like, it's insanity in my mind. But that kind of egregious overreach is what makes people change. And you go, okay, all right, enough. I'm out. I'm gone. And that idea of like, go where you're treated best. So that's an insane positive for Bitcoin, right? What are the risks there? It's like, well, you can just go. But I think it makes it harder to attack. So the regulatory risk is lower. People always bring up things like quantum computing. It's like, is that a reality now? Yes or no? Well, right now, no. I think I've slightly butchered the question in terms of like, it's not really talking about like, what are the risks to Bitcoin? It's more like, what are the risks of using Bitcoin? So let me try and answer that properly. I'm just always looking to make sure that I handle it appropriately. So it kind of like, in the same way, if you went into a laboratory and it's like, wear gloves because you're doing some kind of chemical, you know, my thinking back to my chemistry lessons of 20 years ago, just use the safety gloves, or like, you know, get the chainsaw out, start chopping a tree down and make sure you got some boots on rather than flip-flops. The same thing with Bitcoin. Just make sure you handle it with care, because if you send it to the wrong place, it's gone. If you don't store it in a way that's actually usable, it's gone. Like if you're, so I know of people that have made their self-custody stacks too complicated, and they come back to try and access their Bitcoin. They just can't remember how they did it. It's there. They can see it, but they can't get it. It's like, oh, that would be an absolute disaster. So risks are obviously just handle with care. You are, for the first time, taking true responsibility for what you own. I haven't talked about this enough, but the idea of a property right is, for me, something I hadn't spent much time thinking about before Bitcoin. But in my opinion, it's now obvious to me that Bitcoin is the first time that all humanity has access to true property rights. This is a seriously big deal. But you can potentially own, if you do it correctly, a percentage of a network, and you can be guaranteed to own that same percentage if you self-custody and hold correctly over time. Now, most people will think of a property right as like, oh, you know, are you going to get turfed off the farmland that you own? But then really, like, the amount you get taxed, the amount that those rules change, you're in someone's geographical zone. It's the property rights for real estate holders are getting worse. Not what's the right, they're getting chipped away at and chipped away at and chipped away at constantly. So the risks of Bitcoin, they have to be mirrored to the status quo. It's like, what else? I mean, let's say if it's a pure store of value play, what else are you going to own? Like, seriously, like, what else? Another way of saying this is, Bitcoin forces you to ask the question, why do I own what I own? And there's a lot of legacy wealth sitting out there that people are starting to slowly look at, and they go, why do I own this stuff? Like, for example, people that own holiday houses, they might spend a few weeks a year in them, but for the rest of the year, they have either an agent that takes 20% of the fees, or they manage it themselves. They've got questions from people asking them if they can come and stay with their, you know, three guinea pigs or something, or, you know, the shower breaks and the tenant gets upset, or the tenant leaves with a huge bill. The OPEX, the time, the capital involved in running a small real estate business is painful. And so it's like, what are the risks? What are the risks of your existing setup versus what you could have, which is owning some of the Bitcoin network? What are things that have like really scared me? Again, it's more just usability. So the more you use it, the better. Like, I once was moving some capital pounds out of a bank account into an exchange, into self-custody. I like to do a small transaction first just to make sure it's kind of working, right? And the more I've used it, the more comfortable I've got with not doing that, actually. I just send, like, as long as I know the address is correct, I just know it's going to work. But this one time I sent a significant amount and it didn't turn up. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And it turned out that it was a bank holiday, and the exchange that was in the UK had an operations department that was in charge of this type of transaction, and they were just literally not in the office. And so it wasn't until the next day that it came through, and I got this email being like, oh, hey, you know, we'll just sort that out right now. I'm like, you're sweating balls, right? Like, as I said earlier, it's like losing your wallet on steroids. So it's really just a case of getting familiar with it. And I've seen this to be true a lot, which is the more you know, the more you buy. And it's that sense of conviction that it makes you more relaxed. And that sense of relaxation is really the key. It's like, oh, hang on. So this crazy world that's all around us, you suddenly start to feel more zen. You realize you own this stuff in a way that wasn't possible before. And it is a 10x on the status quo. With that, to anyone out there that is beginning their Bitcoin journey, get into it. It has been the most valuable thing I've ever done. Ask all these 21 questions. I hope that I have managed to answer them in a satisfactory way. They are all my interpretations of the answer. And in some ways, this could have been 21 episodes, right? To try and answer all those questions in just a couple of hours is really hard, because it's an extraordinarily complex thing. The Bitcoin rabbit hole is never ending in many ways. And for that reason, I'm still talking 2 hours later. So awesome. Thank you so much for your time. And reach out if you've ever got any questions. Thank you.